With Spring Black Friday savings at the Home Depot, you can get up to $2,300 off select kitchen packages from top brands like GE Profile. That means you can save on a new GE Profile Smart Quad Door Refrigerator that's full of convenient features like a dual dispense auto fill pitcher and an ice dispenser with up to 12.5 pounds capacity. Bring convenience to your kitchen with smart, innovative appliances from GE Profile. Right now, save up to $2,300 on select kitchen packages with Spring Black Friday savings at the Home Depot. How doers get more done.
Welcome to Savage Starlight, the officially unofficial podcast for The Last of Us on HBO. I'm Jim.
I'm Aaron.
And today, we're talking Season 1, Episode 3, Long, Long Time. Aaron, I don't know about you, but on second watch, this episode somehow got better. I was noticing a lot more of the little details. How are you feeling?
Yeah, like I think people might have detected that I felt a little disconnected from the episode, where it's like I saw that it was good and that I agreed with the change it made from the video game. And, you know, I saw the parts, but it didn't really affect me, you know, and I thought that was weird. It's like, I don't know why, but the other thing is I was having a bit of a two-screen experience. This is why set and setting is so important, where I was trying to keep an eye on the Bengals-Chiefs game, muted in the corner, and then my main eyes on, and it was just like a real bummer of a game because it was so good. And then like I was like, for the last 45 minutes, I was seeing it, you know, interspersed with this TV show.
And you're trying to take notes and all kinds of things.
And there's like, it looks like there's some adventures in officiating, but I don't know what's going on because everything's unmuted. And it's just like that disappointment with the outcome of the game, I think, blended in. Because I've gotten two additional watches of this, because the second time I watched it, I felt like I just didn't. I saw like a black and white version of this fucking episode through a cheesecloth or something, because it fucking really walloped me.
Yeah.
And then the third time I watched it, I really started to pay attention to all the little themes and things that they were doing and setting things up. And like little contrasts and things. This is a minor example. Like, you know, when Bill and Frank first meet and have that dinner, they're set a pose in this long table. And then in their last meal, they're now sitting side by side. Just little things like that. Then the argument that Bill and Frank have about, let me love the things I love the way I want to love, you know.
Yeah, because they have such contrasting styles of love, right?
And then, you know, when Frank's asking Bill to honor his last request, and, you know, Bill's understandably having difficulty understanding how he can do such a thing, and he brings it around. It's like, you know, do you love me? Well, love me how I want you to.
Mm-hmm.
And that stuff was just extraordinarily powerful. And I think somewhere through the second watch through, I was like, these sons of bitches have essentially recreated the first 15 minutes of Up, except for every minute of screen time, they've given it 10 or something like that.
Yeah, because it lasts about 40 seconds and Up, but yeah.
Yeah. And it hits, I think it hits all that harder, but it's just such a great, like, you know, two characters that you don't know shit about other than they're off in the wilderness and they have the taste for 60s, 70s, and 80s music. And turn them into real people, and just with so many glances and words, like all those questions I think we ask, like, it's like, you know, how did Frank know that Bill was receptive to his, how did he clock Bill and all that stuff? Like that, those all had answers that people had sat and thought about and gotten input on. And when you're watching it with the knowledge of that, it all plays.
Yeah. The official podcast is really good on that topic. Yes. They really go over it well, almost too well in some ways, because I'm like, man, do I even need to talk about it now if they're going to do it? But I have a lot of other thoughts on it, so hopefully we'll get into that. But yeah, it's so powerful, this episode of TV. I don't know. I see a lot of people like kind of worrying, well, are we going to do enough with Joel and Ellie? Like, man, just we're not even a third of the way through the series at this point. It's we have plenty of time to get to the Joel and Ellie stuff. This actually informs what we should be thinking about Joel quite a bit if you're paying attention.
Yes.
And that's the part that I love about it. It's both a beautiful story, but it's also related directly to our main protagonist. And
yes,
they've somehow managed to just nail that.
That's what I thought was really incredible, too, the fact that they tie so much of the emotion and what you learn about this episode into the Joel character directly. But we also got a fair amount of character development on the Ellie Joel front.
Yeah.
You know,
I think by the end of the episode, you kind of forget how much is actually going on with Joel and Ellie this episode, because they are really bonding. And that final scene of them driving away in the truck really like puts a stamp on that.
Yeah. Yeah, it's going to be, I think they're doing everything right. I thought this was such a great episode, especially since, and I stand by this, in the game, I think the reveal that Frank is Bill's lover is treated as a bit of a joke. Like this gruff survivalist, you know, dude that's like emotionally constipated and hates everyone. That he had, it's like, you know, when you reveal this, because you can choose, you find his you know, you find Frank's. So should we talk about that's I guess anyway,
yeah, that might be like, spoilery, but
well, no, it's not spoilery, because I've thought a lot about this, and I'm like, I'm yeah, we're going to talk about the actual thing from the video game to compare and contrast it, because like there's no fucking way it can be a spoiler. I played both the video games. Like, there's not going to be zombie Frank and zombie Bill.
No. I don't mean a future spoiler. I mean, for people who wanted to go and play the game, because the story is very different here. It has a similar outcome, but
yeah,
and he's a similar character, but it's,
I don't
it's
know
quite
how
different.
I feel about protecting the virtue of game of a 10-year-old game.
Yeah.
You know, it'd be like not talking
I
about
don't either,
Darth
but...
Vader being Luke's dad, because, oh, what if those people have, well, fucking, you should have gotten around to it. You know,
well, one of my points here for people who are like, well, it wasn't like the game, and so I don't like it, is, well, the game's still there to go play. And so, like, sure, I don't want to ruin that experience for people who may decide that they want to go do that, but to be fair,
but
it's been 10 years, right? So,
and Neil and Craig got it exactly right. The Billtown segment of the game was really fun, of you trying to first by yourself get through these demented traps, and then you team up with Bill, and like Ellie's busting Bill's chops the whole fucking time, and it's a laugh riot, and it's super exciting, pulse pounding. But that's because you are navigating all these action obstacles. If you take that away, there's like the runtime, it's very thin what's actually happening here. It's just an excuse to keep.
Yeah.
So like they recognize that. It's like, well, if we do this Billtown thing straight up, it's like that's just not going to play.
There's very little story there. Yeah.
That's kind of why I wanted to talk about, and I guess if you don't want to hear any spoilers for the game, fast forward to the first commercial break or whatever, because I'm going to talk about it. In the game, you know, Bill and Frank get together, of course, but you find that Frank has escaped or left, and a little ways from Bill's town, you find this body who's hung himself. And you find a note that says that, you know, him and Bill had a big fight, and, you know, Frank was tired of his shit and he decided to leave him and make for the quarantine zone and got bit and then hung himself on the way. And he leaves this note behind that says, Bill, I doubt you'll ever find this note because you were too scared to ever make it to this part in town. But if for some reason you did, I want you to know that I hated your guts. I grew tired of this shitty town, of your set in your ways attitude. I wanted more from life than this than you could ever, and you could never get that. This is the 3-year point in like Frank and Bill's relationship, on that where Frank is so fucking tired of Bill worried more about dying than living, that I do believe that Frank is this close to being like, I'm fucking out of here, I'm going to the quarantine zone, because this guy's just fucking crazy and he's stifling. This Bill in our television universe flexed and let Frank have that love that he wanted to show to his environment, whereas video game Frank, and my, you know, with this new information, I'm gonna guess never did, to where things got worse and worse and worse, and Frank eventually left him. And I just think that's such a, it's such a cool, like, you know, little, like, you know, butterfly flapping its wings, you know, instead of having this like bitter, and the video game version of Bill's got to be said is quite a bit nastier and misanthropic, right? Because he didn't have Frank, or he didn't allow Frank to let the strawberries in to his life.
Yeah, and the thing I love about this episode is it provides so much more context, right? Because you could never really get that from the game. Like, you couldn't get that, oh, this was a pivotal moment. There was a thing here that was just destroying this relationship other than just like, yeah, he's a prepper. I mean, and this is a crazy psychotic world. What do you expect? It doesn't allow you the space to explore a full relationship and the love that could have existed in the game and did in the show. I just think it's a more hopeful, more loving and better all around story for Bill and Frank. I don't want just more darkness. I want a little bit of that light, right? And boy, there's plenty of darkness in this world. We're going to get to even more darkness. We've seen a lot of darkness already. Yeah, give me a little bit of light because, man, the show needs it. And honestly, the world needs it.
Yeah. Like I said, it elevated what I think was kind of like a one-note joke in the video game. Uh-huh. And I don't know, maybe Neil would disagree with that. But I'm like, anytime you introduce this guy and you have a note that's like, you know, they had this relationship and you can choose to give it to him or not and all that. It's like, to me, it's like there's a 60-second har-har, turns out Bill was gay. I mean, that's just, that's just, I don't know. Maybe it's just a twist, make you think. But I always took it as kind of like something that was catering to, I don't know, the gamer point of view at the time. But so yeah, obviously this is better. This is a lot better, and from a storytelling perspective, it blows the other out of the water. Although, like I said, I don't regret, you know, it's not like I wish they did Bill's Town this way. I don't wish that Bill's Town was an unskippable 50-minute love affair between Bill and Frank before
it wouldn't have worked in the game. Yeah, you want action
for
scenes,
precisely that same reason. People would be like, oh my god, how can I not skip this, you know?
Yeah
So
also,
again,
we gotta call it Billville, right? We can't say Bill's Town.
Billville.
Yeah.
Okay, all right. I
know it's Lincoln, but yeah, Billville is the proper
term. It's officially Billville now, for sure.
And you can always go back and play the game, right? Like, if you want that story,
yeah,
if
like you
want
said,
the fuck you, Bill, I hate your guts, I'm leaving story, go play the game. It's still there. It doesn't change a damn thing. All it does is adds to it.
Yeah. Or you can just skip the point where, as soon as Frank storms out and says, I'm fuck you, I'm tired of your shit, just fast forward like 35 minutes and boom, there you go. It's essentially the video game where you skip
shut it off and load up your save at Billville and you're good.
Someone needs to do a remaster where they cut the point and you just play the Billville segment and then seamlessly splice it back in. It's like a despecialized, I don't know.
Yeah, that'd be great. I get
three
missing...
and a half hours of unskippable combat for all you cinema fans.
I do understand like missing some of the action sequences because there are some cool ones. I do like the fridge moment. That stuff is pretty neat. But yeah, it just as a episode of television, it really wouldn't have worked very well.
And I just they talk about it on the main pod. No, this was on the behind the episode, the little video feature they have where Neil and Craig get together, and when they're talking about deviations from the video game, it's like, well, is this the same or worse than what happens in a video game? And if it's that, then they go with what the video game does. But if there's an option it's they think objectively better, they go with that. And that's like, yeah, like even if it's just the same, different is not a virtue. If it's the same, we should probably go with what worked and what the people are what the existing fans are familiar with. And that's, man, because like some of the adaptations I think have gone haywire that I've seen in the last decade or two find difference as a virtue. Like, oh, we want to subvert fans' expectations. Fulfill our expectations. Don't fucking subvert it just because, unless that's a better, yeah. So these guys just feel like they have a solid understanding of adaptation. Like, I just really impressed with Neil Druckmann not really having an ego going into this. And it's a good partnership. It's a hell of a partnership. Reminds me a lot of Lindelof and Perota on the Last of Us, or The Leftovers.
Right. What do you think about, speaking of The Leftovers, what do you think about people declaring this the best episode of television, or let's say the best episode of television in a long time, a decade, whatever? Because I have opinions on it. I think it's an amazing episode of television.
It's pretty fucking good.
It's up there. But when I think about the best episode of television I've ever seen, that Homeward Bound episode of The Leftovers is like just mind-blowingly good to me. talk about like getting misty-eyed in this episode, that one brought me to the freaking floor, man.
Of course, because it had, what, 18 hours of drama behind leading that moment, not 40 minutes?
Fair enough, too, yeah.
But I do think that it is pretty damn good. There's also, you know, yes, your recency bias. You remember what this felt like to watch this episode because it happened 48 hours ago. You other powerful emotional experiences, you know, you might have forgotten. So it's tough. It's, man,
and
I have
for
a
people,
hard time.
This might be the best episode of television they've ever seen.
True.
I wouldn't even say it's not, because a lot of people, A, just it hits them differently, or B, they haven't seen the TV that I've seen. And so, you know, different strokes for different folks, I guess. But man, it was very good. It was very, very good. And a better second time, like I said.
Yeah, and it just like I was just so impressed with Nick Offerman and this Murray Bartlett, who I guess was big in last season's White Lotus. I know a lot of White Lotus fans, and a lot of them were super excited to see him again. I just can't believe how good Nick Offerman, especially, you know, is at essentially being Nick Offerman, but. You know, like just even like his strategic use of the Nick Offerman giggle in this episode.
Yep.
You know, if you've ever seen Nick Offerman doing stand up, if you're watching Parks and Rec, you know that this like gruff fucking man that looks like his face is carved out of granite can just absolutely break out into what I can only describe as a girlish squeal. Mm-hmm. And it seems like it's genuine. It seems like it's kind of like his genuine tickled laugh. And it's great. It makes you smile. And he used it at the perfect time in this episode. And he's just also, this is not a very funny show. He's also really funny. Like this Bill character, as written, is hilarious. Maybe not intentionally, but he's very funny. And the way Nick plays him is funny.
There were a couple of chuckles in there. I really appreciate the chuckle he has. I want to say Nick Offerman is my new favorite sad man. It used to be Robin Williams. But like when you want to bring grief and sadness and just like personify that, Nick Offerman puts that on screen. I think of like Devs when he was extraordinarily sad that entire show, and he just nailed it. And then here he's playing some kind of, you know, alternate universe version of that character as well. And it's he's crushing it. He's great.
A man so sad he violates the laws of causality. It's the eyes, right? Robin Williams and Nick Offerman, if there's something really like Basset Hound like in their eyes.
And I think it's also the comedian doing drama thing, because like
the sad clown
Odenkirk nails this frequently. Yeah, there's something about a man who I'm used to seeing is very funny being very sad that really strikes me.
Yeah. It's good stuff.
Totally. I think we should get on to the recap, but we have a couple of things that we need to do first, because there's been some news.
Do you want the good news or bad news first, Jim?
I'm going to start with the good news.
Okay.
The Last of Us has been renewed for season 2.
This is something that I was kind of taking as a matter of faith with its massive success and Neil and Craig's obvious desire to do it again, to adapt Last of Us Part 2. But it's good. Yeah, it's good to see, you know, in the world, in the era of major corporate merger bullshit, bizarre axing and cancellations over budgetary concerns. It's it's good to see the confirmation.
Yeah, it really puts my mind at ease. I can settle into this season knowing that there will be more of it. And I'm
now the
extremely
only question
excited.
Is one season or two.
That's a good question. We don't know the details on the renewal. We just know that it is going to get a season 2. So,
because correct me if I'm wrong, but The Last of Us 2 feels like it's about twice as long as the first one. The experience of playing it,
It might be approaching that. Yeah,
maybe it's like a 33%. So it's like
50% more. Yeah,
it's a lot harder for me to see them bust that into a 10, you know, 8 to 10 act structure. But on the other hand, it's also very hard for me to see how they can split the material in a way that will have the impact that they want it to. So maybe it's just a super long season, old school, like 16 to 18 episode season.
It's possible. This season is shaping up to be longer than we thought, too, because these episodes have been extended And if that pattern holds, we're going to get like 10 and a half hours of content. So
yeah,
I don't know what they're going to do with that, but whatever they do with it, it'll happen.
It does seem like the HBO is flexible, because the episode, the order was for 10 episodes and they split the first one up into two. No, I'm sorry. They combined the first two episodes into one, which is why we had the super long first one with a 9-episode order, because HBO executives themselves, like, that's what's one of the great things about HBO Creative is, you know, they're not like, we wanted 10 and we're going to get 10. You know, it's like, hey, this would actually work a lot better if we did it like this. And, you know, the episode should be as long as they need to be. I thought that's one thing that Severance did brilliantly last year, is like, they might have a 27-minute episode, they might have an hour 9-minute episode, but they'll be exactly as long as they need to be to get you to the next emotional beat that they want you to leave on. And that's that's how you tell stories, man.
Yeah, that in the weekly format, and we're good.
Yeah. Now the bad news.
Yeah, there was some bad news, and this came out, I think, either as or right before we were doing the instant take on Sunday night. Anna Wershing, who was the voice actor of Tess in the video game, died. She was only 45. She had cancer, and we were, she'd been battling it for a long time. And kept working through it too, was the thing that was crazy to me. She recently, you know, was in Star Trek Picard season 2, which she played the Borg Queen in that. We covered that. And yeah, it's sad, but Craig and Neil had a really nice message for about her on Twitter. I didn't pull that, but if you want to go find it, it's on their socials.
I got the last paragraph. I thought was the meat of it. It says, Annie was a brilliant actor, wonderful mother, a bright light of a human being, something her husband's statement said too. We mourn for her and her children who are grieving their loss. Tonight's episode has become particularly poignant in a way we could have never hoped or wished for, and we're dedicating it to Annie's memory. It might be too late to get that on screen for tonight. Work to get that done as soon as we can. Annie and the Tess she originated will live in our hearts. May she rest in peace. They also linked a GoFundMe for her children. If you want to search for Anne Wershing GoFundMe, it'll be the first result, and maybe your producer can put that in the show notes as well. Because that's the thing. It's like
three young children.
I know she did continue to work, and she was trying to focus on her kids, but like, I think the reality is, like, you know, she's a working actor. I don't think that like a lot of these people, they're doing voice work and doing little, you know, guest genre, they're not like super wealthy, so it's entirely, and she died very young, 45. Kids aged 4 through 12. So yeah, if you do have a little extra and you could help a family out, check out their GoFundMe. But it's tragic that it's, you know, it's so weirdly ironic, or I don't know, the universe being subversive, that it underlines the plot of tonight's, or this weekend's episode.
Yeah, I suppose so. All right. Speaking of this week's episode, let's get into the recap.
Now's the time to endure and survive. We'll be back with more Savage Starlight.
You are about to participate in the most ambitious culinary experiment ever imagined.
This competition is going to test everything.
Adapt quickly to anything. I mean anything. The wildest day of your life starts right now.
All new 24 and 24, Last Chef Standing. Sunday night at 8 on Food Network. Stream on Max.
Hi, I'm going to whisper some things to you now about Crunch chocolate bars. Because apparently this whispering thing is a thing that makes you feel things. It's saying something crunchy is coming in the candy wrapper language. Imagine your tongue hiking up those crispy, rocky ridges. Now, drum roll, please.
Wow, that's good. Crunchy, munchy chocolate doesn't whisper.
Turn up the fun with Crunch.
We're not the cure for mankind, but we have your favorite podcast. Here's more of Savage Starlight. We start off 10 miles west of Boston with Joel piling rocks by a river. Then he and Ellie reluctantly agree to be civil to each other for the 5-hour walk to Bill's place. Of course, the walk was going to feel a lot longer to Joel, with Ellie pressing him for information and a gun, specifically over and over. They stop at a gas station to raid a supply stash, where Ellie finds an infected in the basement and cuts it up a little before killing it. They continue walking, and they come across a plane wreck, which fascinates Ellie. She asks Joel how civilization ended in about a day, and he explains that the cordyceps were in the pancakes, so obviously. They come to a patch of road that has something Joel doesn't want Ellie to see. She goes anyway and is horrified to see an area littered by human remains, but she's even more horrified when Joel tells her how the remains got there, which, yeah, is pretty horrible. The soldiers just rounded up survivors and shot him to keep him from being infected.
Yeah, there's a lot here to talk about.
This episode has a lot of logical breaks in scenes, and I was just going to kind of go section by section. So this might have longer recaps, but hopefully we can still talk about everything that happened.
Yeah, there's this first sequence. I like Ellie kind of asserting herself. You know, she's wanting to broach the test subject, and Joel tries to cut her off and say, "I don't want your sorry." She's like, "Oh, well, good, old man. I'm not giving you one. I'm telling you that I didn't ask for any of this. This is not my fault, and I'm not going to accept any blame for it." And Joel, to his credit, kind of gives her a curt nod, like he understands that some of the bullshit that he's been slinging her way is over this, and she doesn't deserve it. So
yeah, I think it's smart of her to get ahead of this resentment that's going to fester, right?
Yeah, and there's so much that Joel does here, I guess Pedro does with Joel, about, you know, things that are unsaid, like him soaking his knuckles, bloody knuckles, and stacking stones. They talk about this in a podcast. It's make an explicit reference that this is him in some way building a memorial to Tess. Very, you know, transitory. Wait till some leave no trace TikToker finds it, going to run up to it and kick it over. But
sure.
But it's something that he's doing, because he doesn't ever talk about this or wrestle with it openly, right? These little things, like it's the look he has outside on Bill's front yard after, you know, Ellie reads the letter, and it's pretty great.
Yeah, I agree too. I like some of the more frivolous, silly things they're doing, I guess, with world building. Like when, you know, she asks about the scar he's got on his head, he's like, "Yeah, somebody shot at me. They missed." He's like, "Well, did you shoot back? Did you get him?" He's like, "Yeah, shot back. I missed too. Happens a lot more often than you think." It's just, yeah, I bet it does, right? In a gunfight, people aren't. It's not a duel at high noon, right? People aren't turning around, standing still, shooting.
It's not Agent Smith versus Neo, although it must be said they missed a lot too, surprisingly.
They did. Yeah. Just fun little moments like that.
And the fact that, like, yeah, she hits him back with that, because it's, do you suck? Or are you just talking about in like gunfights in general? And it's kind of like an innocent question, but also one that she's, you know, needling him with.
Uh-huh. Yeah, and his, like, look at her before he answers in general is good, real good.
We already talked about in the instant take about our continued disappointment in not seeing a Savage Starlight comic book. And there was a comic book rack, and there was a delighted Ellie making a recognition of a game universe pop culture thing. It's fucking Mortal Kombat 2.
Which, to be fair, I mean, I would probably be looking for a furniture dolly to take that thing back, take that thing with us wherever we're going.
Sure. You know, match that thing. At least grab
the board.
Yeah. Grab the board. Yeah.
You know, you can always find an arcade cabinet. It's not necessarily the boards. It's the monitors that are getting scarce.
Really?
Yeah.
Hmm.
Otherwise need some conversion to hook it up to a LCD or whatever.
Oh no, don't upscale it to LCD. What would I ever do without the CRT phosphors burning into my retina?
Post-apocalyptic arcade purist,
because I'm already to the stage like, you know what, fuck all this, just give me a thumb drive and a pie. I'll play every fucking video game there ever was, but They, you know, just some good quality looting. It's I liked how they split up Ellie and Joel, and she immediately tries to do something dangerous and stupid.
Mm-hmm.
Because again, Ellie's a frustrating character. But also, it's really funny that like this, you know, Joel describes the thing as being thoroughly picked clean. You know, nobody would ever find anything, yeah. And she finds feminine hygiene products, which is like a bunch of dudes picking over the store. Apparently,
yeah,
I like it.
Which I learned to actually expire. You don't want to use those after like 5 years.
Well, is that just because
they get mold and stuff in them because of moisture exposure? Yeah.
Okay. Well, that's bad. Because I was like, is that like the FDA requiring bottles of aspirin to expire because
right.
you got to put something on there? But really, 50-year-old aspirin will probably still cure your headache because I don't know. I'm not a lady. But if I was 20 years in the apocalypse and I've been using whatever the fuck.
Right, rolled
pine
up
cones.
Leaves. What are you?
And shit.
Yeah.
Maybe you roll it. You look at the tampon. You kind of give it the look over. You give it the ocular mm-hmm. pat down. Do you sniff it? Do you kind of tap, see if there's anything growing in it? I don't know. I'm just saying. Ellie was excited to find them.
This is true.
Expired or not.
It's true. The surround sound in that scene was very creepy. When this infected from under the pile, like growls or whatever it does, it came from behind me to my right. And I almost whipped around. And was like, what is that?
Yeah. Really good sound design. I thought it was really great that you can kind of see, you know, this is like the evolution. This is the missing link between the infected that we've seen in previous episodes and the clicker, right? You know, it's like got one good eye, but you can see the sprouts coming out of its right eye socket, and it's completely ruined and big old fucking fungus on its forehead. It's starting to make the sounds. It's going to lead to the clicking, right?
Mm-hmm.
But I still don't know. There's one person in the instant talk that proffered the reason she did all this, especially cutting the infected's head, is to give it a scar like Joel. I don't know, if so, that's a lot darker of an interpretation, because I tried looking at it that way the second and third time. I'm like, I just don't know. I think that Ellie just might be a little fucked up.
Yeah, well,
you know,
what would that indicate? That she wants to kill Joel? That, like, I don't know. She's been brandishing this knife the entire series so far.
Right. And we know she hasn't said that she's killed any infected.
Right.
You know?
And
I'm trying to think she got it infected. We don't know anything about that. And I think that it's a mildly interesting question to, like, in this video game, has she actually killed? Is she concealing information from Joel?
Mm-hmm.
But she's certainly fascinated with his experience. And I think this is more of like Ellie's a little fucked up and she's just like kind of stealing herself and like, well, if I cut this thing, what's it going to do? Is it going to scream? Is it going to yell? And then when it kind of doesn't do anything, she steals herself and like stabs it because I think she wants to impress Joel.
Huh. Okay. To me, she's fucked up in the way that's like, this is some weird revenge for the bite that she's got.
That could be too. That could be too. But I thought it's more of like a test of like, what's this going to do? I've got this thing with a pointy end. If I stick something into it, what's that going to feel like? What's it going to be like? And then, you know, killing one. Because like I said, she wants to impress Joel in a way that like a kid wants to impress an adult.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because I think she does think Joel is cool and she does probably feel better walking around Joel with her outside than she would alone. And, you know, she's aware that he sees her as a pain in the ass and a sheltered kid and all this. And I think she wants to change that.
Totally. I mean, it's one of the reasons she's been asking for a gun incessantly. We haven't really talked about how Ellie feels about her condition. We've never even broached the topic. I wonder if she views it as a burden or if she views it as something that she's proud of or excited about. I mean, she seems willing.
When was she aware of the implication of, like, you know, was it the first day she doesn't die, the second day, the third day?
I think she's aware of it. I think Marlene basically told her how important this
is. From that point forward, for sure, yeah.
Yeah, and now she's aware of it. Like, how does she feel about it?
She seems defensive because anytime anyone hints that there is some kind of obstacle, she gets kind of bristles and is like, "I didn't ask for this."
Mm-hmm.
You know, like I didn't want the this is this kind of what. So yeah, I guess she.
So this could be like her being resentful of these infected who forced this upon her, and now she's on some journey she didn't want.
Do you think she sees this guy as like a lucky person?
Oh,
you know, it's like I'd rather maybe. You know, like, you know, why is this me, why wasn't it you?
Maybe I was just thinking more along the lines of like, you did this to me, now my life is not my own, now my life belongs to the world and I don't like it.
One thing that bothered me when I was watching it the night of was the idea that this guy's still alive down here, because I took it that he had been down there for years. With no access to food, no access to sunlight, no access to nothing. Does that bother you? The fact that this is a little too Walking Dead, you know, like how does a human being, even if you've got it turned down to 1% of its metabolism, how the fuck does it stay alive down there?
I mean, I don't know how long it's been down there, but I don't know how that
there's a lot of dust
infected.
On that hatch, dude. There's a lot
is
of
there?
Dust on that hatch. Yeah, that's what I noticed.
Yeah, you're right. I don't know. I guess I hadn't thought about it much. It doesn't bother me as much as one or two other things in this episode, or at least it didn't.
Right.
Now
you
mentioned it, maybe
about
it will.
Another one. We got a lot more from at least Joel's perspective of how the world ended. Mm-hmm. And best he can figure, people ate tainted stuff, you know, picked up the stuff in the stores Thursday, ate it Thursday night, Friday morning. Got worse and worse throughout the day. By Friday night, they started biting people. By Monday morning, everything was gone. And this kind of tracks with what we see Bill go through and when the power cuts off and so forth and so on.
Mm-hmm.
Does that seem right? That like he said that there's one thing he said that I noticed on the second watch that made me feel like, okay, this is something. He's like, you know, certain brands are sold all over the world. Mm-hmm. And I think about, like, have you ever seen those images that's like Nestle?
Yeah.
And shows like all how much of our food and drink is dominated by one particular company. And they're probably sourcing regionally from these big different, you know, buying in bulk. And like, it like if Nestle's plants had a supply chain problem, you might have a third of the world contaminated within 48 to 72 hours with nothing to, and like that's that you're fucked there. Losing a third of the planet in 72 hours probably kills civilization.
Sure. And then having that third of the population get up and start eating the other two thirds, right?
Doesn't help. Right.
Yeah. So no, it totally painted a picture that I understood. And it made sense to Ellie too. And I love these interactions between them because I feel like they are really starting to bond, the two of them. They're showing that Ellie has a lot of respect for Joel, right? Like he's got information as this old timer that she doesn't have because she's not allowed to by Fedra, right? And he can fill in the gaps in her knowledge, and she's a very curious kid.
He's
providing information and she's warming up to him more and more. And I think they're doing a really good job telling that story.
And we don't know also what Sarah was like, and it seems like, you know, even more than just physical appearance and same age, like, Ellie would be the type of gal that would hang out with her, right? They have kind of the same kind of sarcastic sense of humor. It's a little bit more barbed dealing with Joel, because there's not any affection or love there, but, you know, she's a bit of a wise ass, so is Sarah, and a bit of a free spirit, kind of doing what you thought was right at any given time, so is Sarah, so...
Ellie might be a little more fucked up than Sarah in the head, but
for sure.
I mean, look at the world she was born into, right?
Exactly.
All right. So when Joel shows Ellie this patch of bones here, do we cut right from some fabric with like rainbows and flowers and stuff on it to that's sitting on the skeleton of a woman and a baby? Right to those people who were wearing it on September 30th, 2003. And then we go to a man, and they're the Fedra troops. I guess they wouldn't be Fedra at this point, probably. They'd be just government soldiers. Round people up, and they're doing exactly what Joel described they were doing to these people. And we see a man named Bill, we'll find out, is in his sub-basement hiding from soldiers who are searching his house. They leave town and he emerges and realizes he's got the entire town of Lincoln to himself. And he goes on a post-apocalyptic shopping spree. He gets tools, he gets gas, booze, everything he needs to turn the town into his private booby-trapped oasis. Then he eats a meal alone and watches his defense perimeter do its job.
Yeah, this is a great scene. I love the tense, like you think that, you know, he's a man in his basement and he's waiting for these fedras to open his door. And then you realize that he's in the basement of his basement. This elaborate, like, hidden trapdoor thing. And he's like one of these guys he's no mere prepper. He's a survivalist. Oh,
no. Yeah, he doesn't have 3 milk jugs of water in his garage, right?
Yeah. And I love the detail they provide on a podcast that what Nick says here, it's like, not today, you want new world order jackbooted fucks. Mm-hmm. That was parenthetical, like a note to the actor in the script to let him know what the character is thinking, but not to be said aloud. And apparently Nick, like right before they were going to film the camera, he's like, hey, just if it's OK, I'm just going to say this out loud. Mm-hmm. And Craig's like, fuck it, let her rip. And he did. It's like... it's so close to his Parks and Rec. That's what's so I think that's one of the things that meta works about this. Mm-hmm. Is this is so close to Ron Swanson.
Sure.
This is like an alternate version of Parks and Rec after the zombie apocalypse fell and Ron Swanson fell in love with Ron from Eagleton and okay. lived out the rest uh-huh. of lives. I don't know. It's like it's very, very deeply funny to me for that.
Yeah. I am surprised. So I have a little bit of a problem with these so-called jackbooted thugs or jackbooted fucks. Didn't realize that they were walking on boards that were above a hollow compartment. I mean, when your jackboots hit the wood, you can hear the echo, right? I don't know why they couldn't tell.
You don't think that Nick, you don't think that Ron Swanson can build a sub-basement joist so strong that it doesn't flex or creak?
Fair. He got out there with his hand planer.
Look at what this guy has done.
Chisel.
God.
It's micron tolerances. Yeah, you're right.
That's when Home Depot was open. Like, look, or no,
that's when he had to buy things.
Yeah, look at what he does when there's, you know, no more new stuff. I don't know. I think I didn't have any problem believing
okay.
that they wouldn't detect the difference there.
Fair.
It's just all that when he realizes he's alone, that fierce grin he gets as he begins his
spree. A fantasy of I mean, this is half my fantasy. I'm not a prepper or anything, but man.
Yeah, you
just
think
going
about
on
what?
An adult shopping spree, that'd be amazing.
Yeah, like the fun part of the early goings of Walking Dead was you and I talking about like, oh, what would we do if we, you know, and getting people's feedback. It's a fun thing to think about. And you can tell that this is a guy who's probably swirled a lot of glasses of wine in his rec room thinking, you know, if the first place I'd hit, if the shit hit the fan, first place I'd hit back is, and he's got on, he's just executing. Plan
Delta
Zulu or whatever.
Totally, he has a plan. He uses his boat as a trailer, which I love.
I think it actually is his neighbor's boat. I think he steals that boat.
Oh, does he?
Yeah, I think. Because it's not, he doesn't get out of his garage. That thing is just sitting in a driveway.
It's in a driveway, you're right, maybe.
And we see it outside of his driveway. There's no boat there. So I think he just swipes like, yeah, he said, Jerry ain't gonna use this boat, you know?
Fair. That makes a lot more sense.
Reservation no more.
I was looking. So they're doing an amazing job with environmental storytelling. And yes. We talked about this in the games. They're bringing that over to the show in a way that I really appreciate. They have painted a picture here of a man and they, this is what I mean. Maybe too much information on the official podcast. Cause I was thinking, oh, I'm so clever. I figured out exactly what Bill's backstory is here. But then Craig in the podcast just says it. They do an amazing job with the set dressing of this house, telling me that this is not his house.
Yes.
It is his house now, but it was his mother's house and his parents' house. And they died at some point and he inherited the thing and he hasn't changed a damn bit of it, right? Like you look at the couches, they're all
care.
These old person floral patterns with knitted afghans hanging over the back. There's like antique China cabinets. Like this is not Bill. This is Bill's mom. And
yeah,
it's all just in the set dressing. I think it's brilliant.
Yeah, because it's like, yeah, why would he change? He doesn't give a fuck about any of this shit.
But I was thinking, like, would this man have a boat, or is he spending all of his money on guns and gas and foodstuffs and building a fucking sub basement under the basement?
I actually thought about this because that was my other more persuasive line of evidence that it's not his boat. If Bill had a boat, Bill would not fuck that boat up. Bill would have a use for that boat.
Sure.
Bill would harvest fish or something. He wouldn't like tear to see. So like, I think he just uses it as a trailer to haul shit. So.
No, I think you're right. It's his neighbor's boat. He stole it. I mean, steal. What does that even mean at this point?
He salvaged it.
He salvaged it. Legitimate salvaged it.
Legitimate salvage. Abso-fucking-lutely.
Drove it to Home Depot and filled it up. It was just a really inventive use of a boat.
I was trying to decide if it bothered me that this guy's stuff was still running after 20 years. But I feel like they did enough that the average person shouldn't worry about it. Like, I think you're supposed to understand he has at least a town's worth of gas. I don't know if gas works that way. Like, how long does it take for the big storage tanks to empty out? And maybe a guy could live for the rest of his natural life on 20 years worth of a small town propane supply. And he could keep that going and all that kind of stuff. But I just, like, at one point they got, like, this guy's keeping batteries in the refrigerator and it's component parts so that they're never going to the I'm like, okay, whatever. They've certainly thought a lot about a lot of stuff, and I'm not going to worry too much about it.
And I thought more about the natural gas situation and what's going on there. I think the feds might have shut down the gas plant to preserve it for later potential. I don't know what reason.
Or you just don't want
have
an out of control fire. Like, if a house burns down, suddenly the whole block's exploding.
10 miles from Boston, from the QZ. Yeah, who knows? So they might have shut that down. And that's why the power goes out at Home Depot. And then he goes and turns it back on.
Gotcha.
Because in the instant take, I was thinking, did he turn it off to preserve it so it wouldn't leak? But no, I think it's the other way around.
I also looked into, because we talked about those X markings that the federal agents were making, or I guess FEMA, pre-federal agents were making.
Yeah.
And I guess like an international search and rescue standard that's employed, where the top, so from top and then clockwise, the top thing is the date of search. So we saw they were all like 9:30 or whatever marked. The next quadrant is the any hazards present. Now, I didn't understand the code they use because I think it was NE. I don't know if that means no electric or what. The bottom quadrant is the number of dead or alive found. It's just A0 because they didn't find anyone in the building at all. And then the leftmost quadrant is the unit ID that's conducting the search. So like whatever division of troops this is, that's their identifier. So I don't know. It's kind of neat. I thought it was cool.
Sure. I feel like that makes a lot more sense to use that stuff when you plan on coming back to a location and repairing and revitalizing it.
Well, it might be just to make sure they don't miss anyone. That's the grim.
Sure.
Is like,
I mean,
not
you can just put a big
coming
X.
Back.
I don't know the unit ID to like, okay, let's check the records. Did unit ID number 453 properly inspect? Yeah. But, you know, they've got a system, they're going to use it.
Well, and I guess that's the other thing is like, they don't know until they get the people collected, whether they're going to have room at the QZ.
Yeah.
So it's like, you don't,
maybe
when you're around. Yeah. It's a scary thought, though, the idea that you're trusting these people to show up. I mean, it's the one event that like literally justifies all the crazy, you know, conspiracy stuff. Right. When the world ends and the government,
is full of Nazis, right?
A bunch of fucking unaccountable Nazis making life or death decisions that you have no say over, you know? And your trust, it's a bad time to live through.
Well, if you want comfort, you can always bust out a really nice dinner, and you can watch your Defense Perimeter like it's your favorite rerun of your favorite sitcom.
Yeah,
like Bill's doing here. I really appreciate that. he's just having a TV
Never
dinner,
gets
right?
Old.
Like,
yeah. And it's still such a Ron Swanson move, you know, the guy who had a claymore in front of his desk pointed towards the enemy at all times is just like watching these guys blunder through and get their brains blown out.
Yeah. So we cut 4 years later. It's 2007 now, obviously 4 years into this whole event. Bill's living his life when someone falls into one of his traps. It's a man named Frank who claims he's just trying to get to Boston. After convincing Bill not to kill him and that he's not infected, he asked for some food. The guy seems decently trustworthy, so Bill lets him shower, gives him clothes, and cooks him a meal. Afterward, Frank plays a song on the piano, poorly, and Bill shows him how to really play it, which results in Frank realizing that Bill is gay, kissing him, and then asking him to go take a shower. Once he does, Bill and Frank make love.
They fucked.
They did not fuck.
I just think it's funny when on Bald Move Podcast someone just says and they made love.
I mean, how else would I describe this? It's not
it's very
fucking
respectful, Jim.
Yeah,
very respectful. Yeah, it's first time. Hell, this might be the first time we break down a Tinder gay love scene on this podcast.
Maybe.
I think that there's a couple things I want to say. Number one, I was wondering on the first watch, like, he's clearly fucking with an angle grinder. I'm like, what the fuck is he doing with his angle grinder?
Yes.
But we see later that he's turning these all to where they all operate off of one switch so that they are the spark source for these flame cannons he's building.
Uh-huh.
Which implies that 4 years into the apocalypse, he is tirelessly adding to the traps. It's not like he built these in the first year and was satisfied. No, no, no. Bill is innovating on his multiple interlapping rings of lethality, which I just think is a touch you get on the rewatch.
Yeah, love it.
We also asked, like, what was it about Bill that Frank was able to clock? You've heard the podcast, obviously. What is your understanding of that? And did you see, when on rewatches, did you see that moment?
No, so I listened to the podcast after I had done all my rewatches.
Gotcha.
I didn't have a chance to go back and look for that moment. But Craig Mazin is of the opinion that it is almost immediately. It happens when Frank gets out of the hole and he sees the way that Bill is looking at him. And he realizes then and there. And then at that point, it just becomes a process of, like, almost not quite verification because he knows, but also just like easing into that, right?
Seduction.
Yeah.
It's not a dirty word.
I think he has to seduce himself too, though. I don't think it's just like, oh, he's trying to now seduce Bill. I think it's like,
he's got to talk himself into Nick Offerman. How dare you? Watch out for that fungus. Be right back with more Savage Starlight.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Today's specials are brought to you by Fancy Feast. From impeccable pâtés to silky broths to chef-inspired creations, a memorable mealtime experience is always on the menu for your cat. Learn more at fancyfeast.com.
We found something to fight for. This podcast. Welcome back to Savage Starlight. He doesn't know who Bill is.
Because
right?
The
he
funny thing is I have
gay,
in my notes that,
he is.
That Nick Offerman, I could be Nick Offerman's beard and body double. 100%. You wrap a towel around my waist, it's there. And I don't have his magnificent hair, to my great shame. But how dare you? Mm. Nick Offerman could pull Frank.
Oh, I mean,
doesn't
it's
have to
manifestly
be
so. Yeah.
Isn't it like, they're like, well, who's that fucker on The King of Queens, like Kevin James or something, where you gotta script him into some hot. He can pull, all right?
Yeah.
Jesus.
I agree. But to me, it wasn't that early. I didn't notice it then. When I notice it is when Bill is pouring the wine for Frank. And he notes the pairing of the Beaujolais and the rabbit. I'm like,
gotcha.
Okay. You're picking up on something here for sure.
So I listened to the podcast in between my second and third watch. In fact, the podcast is kind of what inspired the third watch because I'm like, I actually want to see some of this stuff play out.
Mm-hmm.
And I'll be damned. He pops out of that hole and they have that thing about the Arby's and, you know, like Frank's essentially begging for a meal. And there's where Bill kind of wavers and looks away and then he looks at him again and kind of sees him for the first time. And Frank notices Bill noticing him. And you can see this like small smile right before the camera cuts. Like Frank gets a small smile on his face. Like, I fucking saw, I know. And I know you. I see you, man. And from that on, it's just him figuring out the opening.
Sure.
It's like all that shit. I didn't see it the first, and I was kind of leaning towards what you were saying on the second time. Mm-hmm. But yeah, it is like almost instantly. He sees Bill, notice him as an attractive person.
Hmm. I need to take my Gator in for a checkup. It's getting it needs a tune up. I will say the probably big moment here is the Linda Ronstadt song. I think this is it's so beautiful, right? It's the contrast between these two people and their interpretations of this song. And that's the thing about music is and covers essentially is like the way you do the cover says so much about you and says more about you than just playing the song the way that it's written ever could. If you look at the way Frank plays it, it's almost like it's this upbeat, energetic, fast moving kind of dance to it. That Bill is like, that is all fucking wrong, man. You're not seeing this song. You're not seeing the pain in this song. And then Bill sits down and plays it as this like sad ballad, the sad, slow ballad. And you can tell that this is a man who has never felt companionship, has always felt alone. Mm-hmm. And just the way he performs that song is so much different than Frank.
But has wanted it. Like, he clearly had a high school or a college sweetheart that was completely one-sided or unrequited. Maybe he didn't even, you know, maybe he didn't have the courage to step out of the closet, or maybe he didn't feel, you know, confident enough. But there's clearly something there that this is, like, deeply personal. And not only that, it's like, this is a person who's not only never had that experience, but probably given up on ever having that experience because what the hell? Someone's going to come and fall in your fucking hole.
And then you look at Frank as a guy.
Jesus. Anyway, yeah, let's just keep going.
And then you look at Frank as a guy who seems to have very little trouble getting people to like him, probably romantically as well. I don't think this man has ever had a difficult, lonely day in his life. Mm. And so when he sees this person who has had a completely opposite experience, both with this song and with his life, he's drawn to it. I don't want to say he does feel sorry for Bill, but that's not all, right? He sees him as a full person. He understands him in that moment.
Yeah, he sees an attractive person. And I think it's I keep on uncovering these like juxtapositions because, you know, Frank had a group, prefers to be in a group, and is devastated and not functioning well because he's alone. And he finds, you know, Bill, who doesn't want a group, was happy when everyone died, and now it's just going to be me. And he's finding a way to intrude in this guy's life. But yes, there's something, you know, there's something stirring here in Bill. And I took his like casing Bill's joint as him trying to figure out where I would fit in here. Because, okay, maybe he thinks I'm hot. Maybe I think he's attractive. Gotcha. But like he says, I'm not a whore. I'm not going to like pit myself out for a warm place to stay and food.
So he's like, a cheap whore, I think is what he's saying. I won't pit myself out for a lunch, but I will for like a lunch in a few days of roof over my head and
not
shower.
It's not tawdry if we're gonna try to be friends. It's not a one night stand. But like him seeing like that he is just inhabiting this other person's house, and he sees the layer of dust where like this guy clearly has a taste for the fine things and he's living well. But it's very a one dimensional kind of thing. And Frank sees all the things that he could do and he could add to this life. Not the least of which is love.
Not the least of which is dusting. My God. And this is where the environmental storytelling stuff comes in again for me. And becomes even more poignant because you can see by the environment that he's a man who was alone even before the apocalypse hit, right? This is not like, oh, he's been alone for 4 years. When his mom died, that's when he became truly alone. He had no one else, right? Mm-hmm. And then they tell that story just through this being obviously his mom's house and the dust that's accumulated on all the things that she would have kept up. It's, yeah, it's really, really good storytelling. And it doesn't stick out in your face. It's just things you can notice and think about and go, oh, yeah, I see the story here.
And this scene, this awkward scene of, you know, Bill trying to literally tiptoe around his guest and, you know, has no idea how he would make a play and is going to have to rely on Frank to kind of lead. But like the way he's awkward, like he tries to sit down, he snags his gun holster and like it fucks him up. Like his physical comedy timing is so good and makes all that play, because he's like this thing that he's obviously taken a lot of pride and a lot of his self-worth from is now this impediment to him making the moves on this attractive man and making him look dumb and stupid.
And it's his defense mechanisms, right, too? Like, catching on this moment. It's,
yes.
Yeah, it's so symbolic of what he's feeling inside, too. It's
These barriers and literal walls he's put up against outside are keeping him from making this human connection. And, God, it's just, their master of text and subtext.
I know, dude.
Super impressive. And it becomes more so the more I think about it.
Yeah. And I want to say, like, I don't know how much of this to attribute to, like, Druckmann versus Mazin, because I've seen Mazin do this stuff before. I'm hoping it's a combination of both. And when I hear Druckmann talking about this stuff, I really think it is.
Yeah, he gets it.
Yeah, he's not just some spectator watching Craig Mazin write this amazing show. He's participating quite a bit. And then those like moments that sort of defensive nature extends to the bedroom here, right? Like, and even the way he's like standing. I don't know if Nick Offerman typically stands in a very hunched, like,
yeah,
turtle in his shell kind of posture, but in these scenes, he definitely is. And they're like, when they first embrace and Frank kisses him, Bill's like almost shaking because he's scared of this moment. He's excited about this moment. He doesn't know really how to react. And then when you go into the bedroom, he is like, he's extremely vulnerable in a way he doesn't feel comfortable with. And you can see that because like when he's in bed, he's kind of holding his hands over himself a little bit.
To cover up. In giving all these, like, I am incapable of taking the first move. And his relief when Frank says, I'm going to lead and I'll start with the basics is palpable.
Yes. Yeah. Now, some amazing scenes here. So this is going to echo later in the episode, I think, but when I find it hilarious when Frank tells Bill to go take a shower, because like they've just kissed, it's this romantic moment, and then he interrupts it by saying, implying, you stink, please do something about it. I've just taken a shower. You need to fix this situation so that we can.
I didn't notice before, but now that I'm clean.
Right. So we jump ahead 3 years later. It's 2010. We're now 7 years into the apocalypse. Frank argues with Bill because he wants to fix up their town, but Bill doesn't see the use in it. Bill eventually relents when Frank explains that it's how he shows love. Also, Frank says they're going to make friends and they're going to invite them to visit, which probably another argument ensues, but that's exactly what he does. He invites Joel and Tess to share a meal with the two of them. Frank takes Tess inside, leaving Joel and Bill to get acquainted. They don't really like each other, but they can still make a deal for the things they each need. And on the way out, Joel warns Bill to be on the lookout for raiders.
Yeah. Again, another strong scene. This is the point where I think the game reality diverges from the television reality, because in the game reality, I don't think Bill ever lets Frank's souls soar. You know, he never gets strawberries in that universe. But it's just a funny, because, you know, again, it's Nick Offerman, but this guy, it's like, you know, you're in this psycho bunker, 9/11's inside job, the government's all Nazis, and Nick's like exasperated, like, the government is all Nazis. Well, they are now, but not back then. It's, can you imagine how frustrating it would be to argue politics 10 years into the zombie apocalypse, where it's like,
oh God.
Yeah. Like, how are you going to like watch a YouTube video? It's like, you know, or do any kind of research or any kind of like rhetoric. It's be exhausting. But
yeah, I mean, the good news is none of it matters.
Right. But they've clearly gotten into it a time or two.
Yes, totally.
He's like, all I'm asking for is paint and gas for the lawnmower. And then Nick starts to sputter. He's like, if you say resource management one more time, I'm going to run through one of your tripwires. It's just such a funny fucking threat.
And they foreshadowed this argument earlier with the dust on the bar, right? Like they,
yeah,
he runs his finger through. You can see he's a little like you said, he's sizing up. Okay, what role do I fit here? But also, he's dismayed by this. Honestly, it's a beautiful house, right? And that's mm-hmm. the thing. When Ellie walks into, she's like, "What the fuck? This place yeah. is amazing." I think Frank sees that too, and he wants the whole town to be that. He wants their lives to be that. Is the important thing.
And it's also part of, like, well, I'm sure Bill considers a protection. Like, yeah, the more rundown and dilapidated all this stuff looks within, you know, the inside can be as nice as we want it to be. But, like, it attracts less attention. You know, people are going to be less, mm-hmm. You know, enthused by getting past this fearsome fence and all this stuff if it looks like, yeah, it's not going to worth it. It's been abandoned for years anyway. Yeah. So I don't know if that actually, it seems like that would. I almost, that's the other unbelievable thing, the fact that it took so long for raiders to find them, but
yeah,
whatever,
perhaps,
you know, you're in the middle of a small town nowhere.
Yeah, they're just not very far outside of Boston is the thing. 10 yeah, miles like is not much.
It isn't it's a huge population center, and like that's the thing, it's like if you're just talking about Boston, but like the entire mm-hmm. eastern seaboard is essentially mega city one.
Yeah.
There is a bazillion Americans living in that stretch of so it's like it seems crazy that they wouldn't, but I don't know. You got the QZ, I guess that attracts a lot of attention,
mm-hmm.
and you know, probably all the infected and stuff. Like if you just kind of stay quiet and unassuming, it doesn't seem like he ever leaves. Like they don't. Why would they? They don't need anything yeah. else.
Nope.
But and then the fact that like, and also it's like it starts off with like, all I'm asking for is paint and gas. And then, like, you can see Bill's like, okay, fine. And also, we're going to have friends. Where are you going to find friends? Well, I've been mm-hmm. talking to them on the radio. You've been what? Like,
yeah.
It's kind of amazing that Frank's able to just push past this.
Uh huh. Yeah. And then they just cut right to the garden party with Joel and Tess. It's good to see Tess back
yep.
for what I assume is one final moment. I don't know that we're going to get a lot more with her.
The other thing is, like, I felt like this is interesting because it really, this implies that Tess and Joel have been together for over a decade.
Yeah, for like 16
years. That's a lot
years.
Of time for her to share a bed with someone who is so emotionally shut down that he can't even call what they have an official thing. He's like, you know, you got yours and I've got my, mm-hmm. you know, I've got mine. And I, you know, I just thought that was really interesting too, in light of like Tess's last words to Joel. It kind of paints a sad, like mirror image of the Bill and Frank romance.
Yeah. Yeah. There is, some similarities between the two couples, I think. I don't know, cause the official podcast sort of painted Joel as the protector, a failed protector of Tess.
Mm-hmm.
And I never really saw Tess as needing protection in the way that Frank does. Tess, in my mind, can handle herself just as well as Joel. And if anything, well, I guess the similarities lie in the way that Tess approaches Joel, in the way that Frank right. approaches Bill. She's right. trying to steer this man through this world that is broken. And he's a broken man.
Uh-huh.
And trying to heal that and patch it up as best she can, but I don't know, she's not doing as good a job as Frank did, let's just say.
I think you're right about Tess and how she views herself, but I think if you're looking at it from Joel's point of view,
yeah.
I'm not sure if the video yeah. game makes this point, but the idea that he is this failed protector, that he's had multiple people he's cared about
sure.
relying on him, and he hasn't been able to get the job done, and now the backdrop is Ellie, who is like this messianic figure. Not only is he responsible, mm-hmm. but like her safe delivery might redeem all of humankind. And Joel is like shitting his pants
because he's twice
he
failed.
Just doesn't feel like he's worthy, you
yeah.
know?
Mm-hmm.
Desperately, it's like the whole first few episodes, he's desperately trying to pawn this girl off to anyone else. Fucking Fireflies. He hates the Fireflies. Bill doesn't trust Bill or like Bill, but it's just like, I just need to get my battery and get the hell on. And now he's going to have to take responsibility again. And it scares the shit out of him.
Yeah. And I love, sort of Joel's backstory coming into play here, right? They're showing him to be extremely competent in a lot of different areas. He takes one look at Bill's fence and he's like, yeah, that's not going to hold up. And Bill knows it. And
that's
and,
the Bill he Yeah, it's the respect. Yeah, I don't like him, you, right? But yeah, you got me. Uh-huh.
Yeah. And so they do develop a trading relationship. But I just love that as like a contractor, as a construction worker, he probably would be able to identify. It's like I was talking about with the walls in the first episode being framed out weirdly, huh?
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, I like that that aspect that he's got a professional, you know, eye for it, and the way he underlines it. But like, you know, I got this tin spools of high tensile aluminum last you the rest of your life, lives. The kind of like, I know what your leverage is. Just I thought that was really good. It gives Joel a lot more nuance, I think. You know, because it's not fair to say that Tess is the pure brains of the operation. Joel's not a dummy.
Not completely, no.
Yeah.
But she's more of the guide. She's kind of steering it a bit more than he is.
Right. But they're, like, playing it smart, you know? They're letting, you know, it's like, taking the measure of them both, it's like, Tess is essentially going to distract Frank while Joel can make the sales pitch. I thought it was, and it's all, you know, they don't have to communicate. It just happens.
Yeah, so on their way out, a couple of things happen. We find out that it was actually Frank's idea to do the cover songs. Sorry, not the cover songs, the 80s radio codes. Mm-hmm. That was kind of surprising. I guess I didn't see that coming. And then Joel tells Bill that Fedra is not going to come up here. And I don't know why. Do they not want to raid smaller towns for supplies and...
Yeah, you'd think they had systematically worked their way through, like they kept all these records, or maybe they didn't, but like, yeah, you'd think it's like, hey, we came here and there's this and we can go back and get those things, but
yeah,
because the jig would be up. So you get within sight of Frank's town, or I'm sorry, Bill's what'd you call it, Billville. See, Billsville, the jig is going to be up as soon as you see it. It's like one of those things where it's like, there's no security and obscurity here, except for maybe it's like, oh, it's just but you know, Frank fixing a place up is going to fuck all that up. So it's like, if you see this place, you know, there's some good shit here.
Totally. I don't know, but apparently they're not coming up. All right. We cut 3 years later. It's 2013, 10 years in now to the apocalypse. The guys are trying to stay in shape. Frank runs Bill over to a strawberry patch that he's been growing, and Bill loses his mind when he tastes his first fresh berry in years. Later, I don't know if it's that night or a different night, but the Raiders show up under the cover of dark, and Bill manages to fight them off with a big assist from his defense perimeter. He does get shot in the gut, though, and Frank tries to patch him up while Bill is essentially telling him, I'm dying, call Joel. He'll protect you.
Yeah. The talked about Nick Offerman's giggle. It's so great. Like him having, you know, this just purely emotional reaction to, because like you wonder, like you could probably make flour from corn and this, that, and the other, but like what when you run out of cane sugar, what the fuck do you do? Like, I don't think you can grow that in Massachusetts. So it's possible that they haven't had like a sweet thing in years. And this guy gets
high fructose corn syrup. Just distill that syrup down.
Yeah. Can you process that kind of, like, do you need like some kind of still? I honestly don't know.
I don't know.
Like that's a lot more than just a fucking millstone. I know you need, but the idea that like, you know, this is nature's candy and God, it looks so ripe too.
Oh yeah. You
know?
Yeah.
Just like an in-season homegrown strawberry should.
Yeah, the sweetness of like a carrot, for instance, which we saw him growing, that's nothing compared to a strawberry.
Yeah, but blows it away. And I really, there's something that they said on the podcast that he was interested in exploring, like what this mature love relationship looked like. And, you know, he mentioned there's like, I think one of the editors is gay, one of the and like, you know, not just gay, but like an older married man. And like he sought out their
they're
kind
middle
of
aged,
like,
yeah,
middle aged, not older, but like, you know, have that these kind of relationships where it's not like you're in the first, you know, bloom of youth and that it's like, what does it look like? And I just love that detail of obviously there's a romantic moment. Their son is like, it's the magic hour that's filtering through the leaves, and they're very handsome men. And Nick Offerman puts, you know, now he's grown in experience. He's putting the moves on Frank, and Frank's like, come on, not on the strawberries.
I love that. Yeah.
It's a really funny detail.
There's also a thing at the beginning of this shot where they're running, and Frank's like, come on, I got something to show you. And Nick Offerman's like, what? Yeah. He thinks he wants to show him his dick. I don't know.
Yeah.
And he wants to bang over there somewhere, but Nick's already out of breath, huffing and puffing. Yeah.
Yeah.
So,
and it's like one of those best of times, worst of times, because this is like the best day ever in the last 10 years. And that's also, I think, implied to be the night that the Raiders finally show up, because there's no 3 months later, 10 years. It's just, you know, you had this beautiful moment of them making love in the strawberry patch. And then,
I mean, they might be fucking here. Happens. I don't know. This seems more like a fucking situation.
after you survive.
And I like the strawberry thing is so good because it shows the effect that Frank has had on Bill over these past 3 years, right? You go from him wanting to fix up the town, wanting things to be nice and full of life, to now they are. Now they are. And now Bill's appreciating it. It's gone from him resisting it and shouting about it to him being delighted by it.
Yeah, it's like he gets
it. It shows it's something he was missing.
Like, I traded one of your guns for the start. You're one of my guns. And like, it's like almost like it's just a reflex. And Frank knows exactly how to, like, it's just a small one. And also, put this strawberry in your mouth and tell me it wasn't worth.
Uh huh.
Especially when you see this fucker's wall that he still maintains. Like, yeah.
No, it's a great pairing with the previous scene, like Rabbit and Beaujolais. And then we get the other pairing, which is the Raiders showing up. I have minor problems with this scene that we'll talk about, but I do love the defense system. Like you said, we saw him building it earlier. We didn't realize it, but once those sparks start up, I'm like, oh, those are the angle grinders or whatever he was using.
Right.
To spark this. And boy, it lights these fools up.
It does. And that's like, that's the thing. You see them, all the components going together, like the pipes in the ground. I'm like, is this some kind of mortar shell? Or, you know, is it packing full of ball bearings and black powder? It's going to be like, you know, a claymore or whatever. And then you see the angle grinder. What the fuck is that? But as soon as those angle grinders fire up in the night, it's like instantly I'm like, oh, shit. This is just a giant Bic spark wheel.
Right,
and these guys are about to get roasted. They do.
It's got to be so confusing to them. Like, they probably haven't seen machinery operating in a decade,
and they're thinking, "We got the drop on this motherfucker. Uh-huh. We cut his power. We're cutting his fence. And it's in dead of night. We just watch him fuck on the strawberries and get drunk off wine. We are going to have ourselves a time tonight." And they get hardcore fucked by Bill's fence.
And I like the idea of using fire too at night, because it would fuck with your night vision, right?
It would.
It would mask somebody who, let's say, was in a firefight, standing in the middle of a street firing a gun and yelling.
Yeah. Glad you wanted to talk about this.
It would make it harder to hit that person, but that person is still an idiot. What are you doing, Bill? You're standing with no cover. You're just asking to get shot.
It's so dumb. Like, Bill wouldn't have an elaborate system of sniper nests. And I still think you could have him get shot in the love handle if you wanted to. But, like, that was just, I, you know.
It's an unforced error in a show that I didn't think was going to make these errors.
Because they have to have some kind of military advisor, right, to do some of the stunts and things. It's like,
I don't think you need one for this. This is just plain silly.
I really don't think it occurs to them. And the way that, like, you know, Craig was like, oh, you know, if I want to depict this mature gay love, I should probably talk to some mature gay people and, you know, kind of get some opinions and stuff. It's just like, when it's an action scene, I hope it's not a sign of things to come. So it's like, oh, we'll just do whatever looks cool. And we'll just wing it. Like, okay, it really did take me out of the scene.
It makes Bill look a lot dumber than the rest of the episode. And that was the problem I had with it. It's not necessarily, like, that he gets shot or that he's in the middle of the street. But the guy he is would be up in a sniper's nest window somewhere picking people off. Not out in the middle of a street like a crazy man.
yeah, you take advantage, like you said, you just night blinded these fools, and you know, like I said, in a lot of matches, a lot of people don't notice these things, but I thought it was pretty dumb, because you're right. If Bill is that type of prepper, he wouldn't have lasted 3 months.
Right.
There are, you know, and I think a lot of people who are prepping are doing it for hobbies or doing it for the aesthetic or doing it just for, you know, a hobby essentially. But there are the people who know a lot of shit and can get a lot of shit done, and they've told me that Bill is that guy. Maybe he just got so fucking gun nuts at the idea that these guys are coming to take his, that he would like completely abandon all of his training and probably the scenarios he had in his and call some wild hair. But like,
he's been waiting for this moment. This is his moment to shine. All he's seen so far are infected, they're taken out by his perimeter, right, but now
right
maybe, but he didn't seem like that kind of guy.
No, it felt like a slight misstep.
Mm-hmm. Here's the thing it does, though, that I like. Bill getting shot and Frank taking him inside and trying to keep him from bleeding out here. I think this is really good. At first watch, I didn't see the point in it. I'm like, well, if Bill's going to get shot, we're just going to cut 10 years in the future and he's going to be fine. Why have Bill get shot? The thing it shows me is that Bill has gone from worrying about his own survival to worrying about Frank's survival. Because in his final moments, or what you think are going to be his final moments, what he thinks will, he's concerned about protecting Frank. He wants Frank, he's left him a list of things. He knows where all the keys are. He's been thinking about this for a while. If I get killed, if I'm incapacitated in some way, Frank needs the ability to survive. And that means I've got an operation here, a procedure, and I want him to call Joel because he knows that Joel is just like him in the ways that matter.
He can trust him in, like you said, the ways that matter.
Yeah. And so I think it's really important here for Bill to think he's dying, even though we're going to find out 3 seconds later he's not. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So let's talk about this next sequence. It's 10 years later. It's now 2023. We're almost to current day, just by maybe a week or so. We're now 20 years in. Bill survived the gut shot, but now Frank is in a wheelchair and he's dying of cancer. Dying of something. I think they said it's probably MS. That's kind of what I was guessing.
Yeah, MLS, ALS, some kind of degenerative neurological or muscle disease.
Mm-hmm.
Lou Gehrig's type of thing.
Yeah, we see Joel taking care of him throughout the day. That would be an entirely different scene. We see Bill taking care of Frank throughout the day. The next morning, Frank tells Bill that he wants this to be his last day, and he lays out a plan for them to get dressed up, to get married, to eat a nice meal, and then have Bill crush up a lethal dose of his medication, put it in his wine. He'll drink it, they'll go to bed together, and Frank just won't wake up. And that's exactly what happens. With one minor twist, Bill also drinks the medicated wine.
Now, when we go to the ad, make every shot count. We'll be back with more of Savage Starlight.
We try to make it super easy to support making podcasts at Bald Move. Just join the club.
But some people aren't the joining type, or maybe they're already in the club but want to add a little bit of gratuity for an especially great season of coverage, or for a podcast that really spoke to them, or gave them that bit of support in a tough time.
For these, and for whatever other reason you might have, our tip jar is always open. Head over to support.baldmove.com and click the donate option to say, hey, keep doing what you're doing. We appreciate it.
Once again, check out support.baldmove.com for all the great ways to help me and Jim keep making the podcast you love. Commission podcasts are an awesome feature here at Bald Move that allows you, the individual listener, to decide what we talk about for a single podcast.
The community loves it because it often leads to fun, fan-favorite films and TV shows that we've overlooked getting the coverage they deserve.
And we love it because we're constantly exposed to great stuff that's not even on our radar.
The way it works is simple. You go to support.baldmove.com and you click on commissions. Then you pay the flat rate for the commission and tell us what 2-ish hours of content you'd like us to make podcasts on.
Then we'll contact you for details, advanced feedback, and any dedications you'd like to make.
Then we watch the thing, discuss the thing, turn it into a podcast, and pump it right into your ears.
We get consistently great feedback on how much our commissioners love their podcast, and they make great gifts for the dedicated Bald Move fan in your life.
And who knows, that dedicated fan could even be you. Treat yourself. Check out support.baldmove.com for more info. We're not the cure for mankind, but we have your favorite podcast. Here's more of Savage Starlight.
This is the warhead that the episode delivers, because this is just extremely, it's bittersweet. It's touching and endearing and beautiful. I mean, that's the thing. It's like a lot of times in life, almost all good love stories are going to end tragically because nobody's going to live forever.
Mm-hmm.
And the extent of the pain is the extent of the love. And you can tell that there was a lot there. And I just like it, you know, these old guys, and Bill's kind of puttering around, and he catches Frank looking at him as he's painting, and he gives him a wink as he's watering flowers. It's just like, I just thought it was extremely cute. And like that Bill's probably clearly scared to death, because even if they don't do the Frank option, you can see the end is clear. And it's so poignant, because in the other scene, Bill is worried about getting old before Frank.
Yep.
And now here, suddenly Frank is wasting away. And just how Bill goes through like this compressed grief cycle where he's trying to be in denial about, well, what if we find a doctor, and all this other ridiculous things to try to like talk Frank out of. And then Frank's like, you know, you've given me a lot of good days, and I want you to give me one more. And I want you to love me the way I want you to. And it's great. There's these, you know, this montage of all the paintings. I think it's funny. They're just all Bill. I think there's maybe one of Joel, but like there's just like a dozen paintings of Bill, and like the montage that they show you of their strawberry patch and Frank's hole. That I think it's funny that Bill never filled in. Like it's like some kind of like inside joke or, you know, thing that they like to walk past and like, imagine it all started down here, kind of like, you know, like the first place you meet your sweetheart, you go back and revisit on your anniversaries. I thought that was a kind of a touching detail.
Sure.
And the marriage ceremony, oh my God, at the piano, like all this stuff is, the last time I can remember music having this big of an impact on the visuals is The Last of Us. I'm sorry, is The Leftovers. God damn.
Okay.
It's the Leftovers of Us.
Yeah, absolutely.
Because like all this is like this sequence, this montage is not set to anything but the music, and that mournful guitar and what they do with the arrangement of Long, Long Time, it's pretty pretty amazing. It definitely worked on me.
Absolutely.
Craig Mazin mentioned that he's seen this scene probably 200 times in editing, and it gets him teared up every single time, and I kind of believe it.
Yeah. Yeah, how could it not? The thing that gets me to, like, one of the big moments, which is actually a very small moment, is Frank trying to keep up his smile during the dinner as that bottle of wine is coming out. Bill leaves the room or turns his back, and Frank kind of lets the smile drop. He's like, am I going to do, this is it. This is the moment. And then when Bill turns around, that smile comes back, because he doesn't want, I don't know. I think he's trying to keep up a light heart for Bill this entire time, because he knows how painful this is for Bill. He's trying to ease that pain a bit.
Yeah, I think there's maybe a little bit of him being afraid to go, because like that's there's got to be something there. That's like, you know, it's like, because he's worried about
this is
about
the
it
moment
be
it's
enough.
Becoming real. I mean, the wine is being put in front of him, right?
This is like, is this my last? This was such like, you know, that's a paradox of having that last good day. Is like, I just had a good day.
Tomorrow
I
could
have
like
more.
This.
But I also could, like, you know, get worse and worse and worse. And this is, I wish that this is, you know, I could have gone out with the dignity I had on today. It's, like, end of life decisions are, they're complicated.
And it's all there in his expression in that one moment.
Yes.
And I think that's the beauty of it, is how subtle it is, too. It's not, hitting you over the head with big exposition or something.
Yeah, again, Murray Bartlett was really knocked it out of the park.
Yeah.
And we talked about this in Instant Take, but I think the aging makeup was really good on both of these guys.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like Frank looked extra beleaguered because, like, you know, this disease has probably, you know, caught him up to Bill in a way. And, you know, Nick Offerman looked like, you know, in a first scene, like when the sun's hitting him and you just see his like white kind of hair. It's like very Santa Claus-y. And
yeah. And they put made this skin a little less smooth, but some deep crease wrinkles, some maybe liver spots or something. Who
dark
knows?
Smudges just around the eyes, some sunken eyes. And yeah, just the way they reversed that scene, the first dinner, he runs that back, and except for at the end of the table, with all this distance and things unspoken between them, now they just, it's got this mature love. Mm-hmm. I liked how Bill revealed. Now, I think Frank knew it as soon as Bill drains his glass. Like, yep, he knows him enough to realize there's been a little bit of hoodwinking going on. And
he drinks it in the exact same manner as Frank does. That resigned, this is it. I'm going to drink it so fast I can't turn back.
Yeah, apparently this is a reference to a play. This line about this is not the tragic suicide at the end of the play. This is a reference to a play that Craig Mazin saw when I guess it was like, you know, I think it's like I understand it's like 20 years ago, some off-Broadway thing where, you know, there's a lot of obviously AIDS and going through that, and there is a lot of, like, you know, people dying tragically at the end of these, you know, plays about gay men. And I guess one character says, no, don't worry, this isn't a tragic suicide, this isn't a tragic death in the end of the play. And him saying, this isn't a Romeo and Juliet thing, I'm old, I am satisfied, you are my purpose. And if you can choose to go out without pain and dignity, then I can too. And the way they got to like laughing about it, you know, because, yeah, what the fuck is Frank going to say?
Right.
And it's acknowledging the fact that it is incredibly romantic, because it's not Romeo and Juliet, right?
Sure, sure.
And it's, yeah, it's the waterworks turn on as surely as Bill's propane defense.
Yeah, also in this moment, another thing that was going through my head is like, wait, both of these guys are dead. I know that the radio turned on and they were playing 80s music as if there was trouble. How is that possible, given the time frame? And we're going to find out. I'm very happy the episode told us, because I did not want that to be a lingering question.
Sure.
Or just an oversight. God, that would have been terrible. But yeah, then we flash back to, or flash forward, I guess, a few days to current day, where Joel and Ellie enter Lincoln or Billville and discover that Bill and Frank are dead. Bill left Joel a note telling him what happened and urging him to raid his stash and use his supplies to keep Tess safe. He also left him a key to his truck. So Joel agrees to take Ellie with him to find Tommy, because Tommy used to be a Firefly and might know where they are. But only if Ellie agrees to three rules. A, don't talk about Trauma Club. B, don't tell anyone about your condition. And C, what I say goes. So Joel and Ellie proceed to raid Bill's stash, during which time Joel makes a battery for the truck, takes a shower. Ellie finds a gun and hides it in her bag. And then they drive out of town with Linda Ronstadt on the radio.
Yeah. You know, this feels very much like a epilogue, you know, to what we just saw. But there's a couple important things. I know a lot of gamers excited to see Ellie, you know, put on the actual t-shirt from the game.
Okay.
I was excited to see them rocking the 90 degree trademark Last of Us flashlights on their backpack straps, you know.
Nice.
And just like this Pater's doing a lot of subtle work, like where he's overcome by the fact, you know, like it's been something he's been thinking about. But Bill kind of like from the grave accusing him of failing at his job. The one thing is that makes life worth living. You fucked up and he has to go out to the front yard to think about it.
And he's potentially being given yet another opportunity. Right. And that's both attractive to him, I think, but also very scary.
A heavy responsibility for sure.
Yeah. I love the moment, the very first moment of this, when they get through the gate and they walk up to the house, there's a shot there that lingers on the flowers, and you can see that the flowers are dying, and you can see Joel noticing that the flowers are dying, and he's like, oh yeah, Frank, there's something wrong with Frank, because Frank would never let that happen. And it's just a nice little moment of like, you get the impression that he's really gotten to know these people over the years.
Yeah, and there's a lot of other, you reminded me of other little things that they show, kind of like storytelling. Like, for example, when we see them flash forward after Joel has the conversation about the aluminum, clearly he's sold him a couple of aluminum spools, but you also see a big section of the fence that's been replaced by wrecked automobiles and stuff.
Yeah.
Like, Frank's like, I don't need your goddamn 10 spools, but I'll take 3 off you. And he's kind of like, he's like, yeah, it's like, I trust, but he doesn't want to get over in debt with him. There's like little subtle kind of storytelling, I think, with them doing the environments. Mm-hmm. But yeah, and I also thought, like, you know, him playing, like, when he sees this vehicle and he gets it open, there's no battery, and him just like, you know, just like being like, Jesus Christ, I can't. And then I bet Bill's got something. He does. This motherfucker's got the constituent components of a battery that you would need.
Dude, this is a very effective, like, the club for your car, right? Like a theft deterrent device. Because who the fuck is going to be able to build a battery out of components?
Right.
But B, in time to steal your truck when you break in.
Yeah, I thought that was really funny that they kind of like do this fake out with the audience and Joel. And Joel comes back, like, that's like I thought there was this kind of the ghost of Tess, like, can't you just accept that we get a win once? Because I think that battery gives him like clarity. He goes in, he's like, let me see your arm. All right, it's healing. Okay, I'm now locked in. You know, I've got a plan. I've got a vehicle. I've got a verified Messiah girl. And by God, I'm going to at least get her to Tommy to see if I can foist her onto him. And best of all, she's cool with the plan. So we're good to go.
Oh, she says she's cool with the plan. Dude, if you think she's going to just go along with everything you say on this journey, you're a little naive.
I do think Joel... Oh, go ahead.
I was going to say, I love a couple of the bookends of this episode, you know, with another shopping spree here. This time it's in Bill's stash. Bill's done the shopping spree, and now they do the shopping spree within his supermarket here. And this suggestion of, like, Joel going to take a shower, I think is both... You know, real world, it makes a lot of sense. He probably smells pretty bad too. But B, I think it thematically connects Bill and Joel even more. You know, Bill was told to go take a shower when, like, he was first embarking on a relationship with someone. And I think Joel is doing kind of the same thing here, or he's 100%. Having the same experience. Different kind of love, but definitely some kind of relationship is forming here. And I got that impression throughout this episode, which is why I don't understand why people are so... Why certain people are so up in arms about, like, well, this doesn't give us enough time with Joel and Ellie. They're not going to be able to bond them only 3 episodes in. I'm not getting antsy. What I'm feeling is they are doing a lot of very efficient bonding of these two characters. It's moments like the Linda Ronstadt. It's moments like Joel just explaining how the apocalypse started. Those types of moments are really making me feel like there is something happening between these two that's causing Joel to feel like he needs to protect her.
Yeah, I think it's coming from a lot of people who are like inexperienced media watchers. Like, if you like, I feel like that's like a criticism only a game fan would make, because that implies that you're a little bit younger. It also implies, like, if you're a hardcore gamer, you probably play video games much more than you watch like prestige dramas and things like that. So, like,
you only have so much time. Yeah.
Yeah, you're going to have so much time. You're playing games 6 to 8 hours a day, then you're not going to have time to watch a lot of TV. And, you know, it's stereotype, but I think it's accurate. The type of stuff that really hardcore video game people watch is probably more along the lines of anime and, like, science fiction, fantasy, comic book stuff, and, like, slower, deliberate storytelling paces. Even though you subconsciously appreciate that about the Last of Us, this is the first significant deviation, and the fact that it took you away from your favorites, your POV characters from the game, I could see that being antsy if you're, you know, in your, you know, anywhere from your teens to mid to late 20s, that, like, oh, I don't know. I don't know. It's Craig Mazin. I don't know. This might be they might be shit in the bed of my favorite video. I can see it, but
yeah, I just look ahead and I see
overreaction.
We have six more episodes where they could potentially be together and bonding. Like, I don't need every episode to be that.
Yeah. Yeah.
But even then, if I don't need every episode to be it, this episode is still that. They're doing so much with the like roughly 30 minutes of screen time. Because it's a lot. It's a lot of screen time that Joel and Ellie actually get in this episode if you watch it. Yeah, it's more Bill and Frank, but it's still quite a bit of Joel and Ellie.
Right. And that's the other quintessential thing about their relationship is like her fascination with him being kind of a living fossil of a bygone time, you know? Her getting in a car. This plane was a great scene because, like, you know, like, of course she would be impressed that you were in the sky, motherfucker.
And he's not. He's just like, yeah, I had to sit next to some dude who snored and had his
I got in the middle seat, paid
$15
like, for a shit sandwich. Yeah,
right. And a 4-year-old was kicking the back of my seat the entire flight. Mm-hmm. It was hell. And she's just like amazed. You were in the air, man.
Sure.
I can never experience that.
Right.
And the same with the car. The car scene. I think you were about to mention this.
Yeah,
with the seatbelt.
She treats this shitty S10 like it's a literal spaceship because to her, right. like a clean house in well working order is a miracle to her because she's never seen something that isn't like Mad Max levels of dilapidated. And this working vehicle with like air conditioning and music players and stuff, like it must seem like a magic thing.
The fact that she doesn't even know how to put on a seatbelt.
Exactly. Exactly.
She's it's like, oh, going, so cool.
Yeah, and like there's a little bit like, you know, like when I was a kid, you know, my granddad, the house he grew up didn't have central plumbing. You know, he still had electricity because he's not that old. And like my son is sometimes fascinated at the idea of life before the internet and smartphones.
Oh yeah.
Like how did you get you know, when you didn't have Google Maps, what did you do? It's like, well, we used real maps or we just kind of knew where to go. And that's like, but this is like, this is a unique opportunity where it's like literally you went to back in time or to another dimension where the way of life that Joel knew and Sarah knew is something that Ellie can't even conceive. I love when you see those moments where Ellie they see this wonder, you know.
And in the case of an airplane, something they'll never get back to in her lifetime.
Probably not.
The crazy thing. Yeah, I mean, maybe if they miraculously like cure this thing or something, but like, yeah, chances are she'll never get to experience that stuff. So, I don't know. I love it. Joel's a big Linda Ronstadt fan too. Apparently, he's telling her all about it. I learned some things about Linda Ronstadt. She was apparently, I think we would have got along. I don't know. She was she called herself a spiritual atheist. She was an early gay rights activist, marriage equality activist. I found out she has a pretty high profile series of boyfriends. She was dating Jerry Brown, who was California governor back in the 70s.
Sure.
She dated Jim Carrey for a while. And she was engaged to George Lucas.
Wow.
It was wild.
That
I
is
had no
quite
idea.
The cross section.
Right. So I don't know. She, that's why, like, when I was talking in the instant take about like Linda Ronstadt kind of being a thing where you're like, oh, okay, now I see Bill's gay. She was
a little bit
gay rights activist. Icon. So like, yeah, a lot of the music. It's like the Carpenters. If you tell me a man is a big fan of the Carpenters, like maybe too big a fan of the Carpenters to be straight, I'm like, okay, yeah, he's probably gay.
I'm a pretty big fan of Carpenters, Jim.
Oh, yeah? All right.
So they also end at the Bill and Frank's bedroom window, which is this. They went into this podcast that their intention was to have each episode open on a window to kind of like, because that's the game start screen. When you load up The Last of Us, it has this, you know, post-apocalyptic looking window with the sun coming through it and this like drape blown in the breeze and like a tendril of green that's kind of growing through it. and they wanted to have that kind of motif. And you can kind of see they never could quite get it to where it wasn't like too much of a showy kind of thing. Mm-hmm. And they also, I guess, wanted to like they thought it'd be really cool if like when you played the episode, if it sat there until you hit the play button and it would say like press play to continue to give that. But they're like, yeah, that's kind of silly. But you do see window imagery has continued to come. So they didn't use it that way, but they had the shots and they were able. And this is, you know,
I think
it
they
felt very
compromise.
The Last of Us.
They should have compromised. They should have done that for the very first episode.
Mm.
And then not do it for this. Because I think it would get old by the time, like, God, I just watched like trailers where I had to skip. I just watched a theme intro where I had to skip. And now you want me to press play to start your damn episode again?
Mm, yeah.
That would have been annoying. But on the first one? Yeah.
I think you could have. I feel like there's ways to do that. Like, there's been some shticky kind of. Like, didn't The Watchmen always have some kind of shtick that it opened with? That was like a comic book cover, a particular way they did things. There's ways I think you can do that. I know that like Invincible always had the logo splash and it got bloodier and bloodier as the season went on. I think you can do it. But yeah, like it's making people play double clutch the play button might be a lot. What else we got to talk about?
I think that's it, man. What a good episode.
Okay. Well, if you got some feedback, we still have a little bit more coverage of episode 3 by the end of the week. Thursday in particular, we'll be recording a feedback episode. So make sure you get that in early on Thursday morning, Wednesday night, preferably, to TLOU, TLOU at baldmove.com. That stands for The Last of Us, of course. TLOU at baldmove.com. Anything you send in there, as time permits, we will consider. We'll probably also have a spoilore section, I imagine, if there's questions that deal with the second video game or, you know, the later video game events. And then we'll be doing this again on Sunday night. Now, Jim won't be with us Sunday because Saturday and Sunday, Jim and I are doing our 24-hour Groundhog Day movie watching marathon. We're going to watch every movie in the Fast and Furious franchise in order of release. It's going to take us 24 hours to get through. We're going to be raising money for the Cure Owls Foundation. And Jim's going to be sound asleep. The way I work, I usually take essentially like a 6-hour nap and I get up for a couple hours and I go back to sleep. So in that period of wakefulness, I'm going to conduct a podcast. I got my buddy Anthony from the Hot D/Bookaloo coverage. He has been watching this show and is a big fan. He'll be substituting in for Jim, but we will have our live reaction podcast out Sunday night. You're welcome to join us if you want to be a club member. support.baldmove.com if you want to join the club. And of course, all existing club members invited to join us, watch live or enjoy the Instant Talk, Instant Take podcast afterwards. That's our plans for this week. I can't wait to see episode 4, and we'll see you then. Until then, I'm Aaron.
And I'm Jim.
Later.